today on Against the Grain. It's both a precious resource and a dangerous pollutant. Exponentially increasing crop yields while fouling our waterways with blue-green algae. The element phosphorus has played a crucial role in agriculture and war, while its reserves are unevenly distributed, with much of the world's supply located in the occupied territory of Western Sahara. Writer Dan Egan discusses the double-edged nature of an element that is increasingly depleted and overused. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Discovered by an alchemist in the 16th century, the element phosphorus has played an outsized role in all of human life and is now playing a central part in the pollution of our waterways with algae blooms. My guest today, Dan Egan, is an award-winning writer. He's the author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. He's journalist in residence at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Science. His recent book is The Devil's Element, Phosphorus and a World Out of Balance, which is published by Norton. Let's begin with blue-green algae, one of the most visible manifestations of the deleterious consequences of phosphorus run amok. What is blue-green algae and why is it so serious?
Blue-green algae isn't actually an algae. It's a photosynthesizing bacteria, formerly known as cyanobacteria, and it's completely natural. It's actually the stuff that kicked enough oxygen into the atmosphere billions of years ago that we have life on Earth as we know it today. But what's been happening in recent years is we've been getting extraordinary concentrations of it in fresh waters across the country and really across the globe. And that brings with it some serious ramifications.
Well, tell us what some of those are. What are the dangers to public health? What are the dangers to ecosystems and animals, whether they're, you know, someone's pet or animals out in the wider world?
Yeah, it's toxic and you know, it's poisonous to animals, pets as well as humans. And the disease or the affliction that you can get from exposure to this stuff ranges from respiratory issues to liver function issues to even neurological concerns. It's killed a lot of pets in the last 10 years. And one thing that's interesting is it's kind of hard to tease out, is this stuff getting worse or are people paying closer attention to it? I think it's a bit of both, but I think it's getting worse than people are just paying attention to it.
What are the factors that have led to this extensive growth of blue-green algae? Climate change has been flagged as one aspect. Another has been invasive species like zebra mussels, which often inhabit the same places that have been taken over by blue-green algae. How should we rate those, and then what are you arguing is really the driving force of the algae that has proliferated so alarmingly?
Yeah, you're right. It is a suite of factors, and I would say the primary one is we're overdosing the landscape with agriculture fertilizer, both chemical fertilizer that comes from a factory and manure, poop that comes from cows. That's long been used as, you know, a natural nutrient to grow things like wheat and soy and corn. And it works miracles, both manure and chemical fertilizer. But the unfortunate and problematic thing is that its ability to make stuff grow doesn't disappear when it trickles or washes or gushes off the landscape and into fresh water bodies. That's where it grows this toxic algae that we're talking about. But that's the number one driver, but you're right. Climate change is having an effect because this stuff loves warm water. And it also feasts on the carbon, the increasing levels of carbon in the atmosphere. And then there are some local issues where climate factors might lead to a prolonged string of calm days in which this stuff can grow in a slick on a pond or a lake. And when you see it on a flat body of water, it looks like somebody spilled a can of paint, lime green or Kelly green paint, into the water. And then another factor, as you mentioned, is zebra and quagga mussels. Those are invasive species that came from the Caspian Sea basin about 35 years ago, and they arrived on the continent in the ballast water of overseas ships sailing from Europe up the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is an artificial connection between the Great Lakes and the Atlantic seaboard. And the ballast water is used to steady a ship on open waters, and it's critical to the safe operating of a freighter. But it isn't dead water. It's thriving and alive with stuff. And unfortunately, two of those species include quagga and zebra mussels. And these are little tiny fingernail-sized filter-feeding mollusks. And you can go out on YouTube and see videos of these things in an aquarium or in a laboratory. And they will siphon out of the water pretty much everything that's floating in it. They're eating, you know, they're feasting. But certain flecks, they'll spit back out. And that's this toxic blue-green algae, this cyanobacteria. And so this really helps these two species thrive because they have very little competition from native plankton. And that's been a real driving factor in Lake Erie, which is particularly afflicted by this stuff. And you're asking earlier, what are the consequences beyond human health? Well, in Lake Erie, the stuff can, you know, grow so dense and is so prolific that it can suck the life out of the water. And by that I mean, when it dies, it decays, and that burns up oxygen, and that creates these vast, massive dead zones in Lake Erie that can span hundreds of square miles. And it's doing similar things on other water bodies as well.
Sure. So you mentioned a minute or so ago that chemical fertilizers and manure both are significant drivers of blue-green algae. Now, if I have it right, chemical fertilizers are made with three crucial elements, potassium, nitrogen, and phosphorus. Tell us about the significance of those fertilizers, especially the one that is the scarcest and the subject of your book, The Devil's Element, and that is phosphorus. Why is it so important in helping magnify, intensify plant growth, crop yields, and why is it also so potentially dangerous as well, this sort of double-edged element?
Yeah, you're correct. The three primary elements that go into modern chemical fertilizer are nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And nitrogen used to be scarce until 1909, when the Haber-Bosch process was invented that basically allowed us to pull nitrogen out of the air and put it into a form of fertilizer suitable for a crop. I can't remember the number, 70 or 80% of air is nitrogen. So there's an abundance of it. It just wasn't in an accessible form until just over 100 years ago. Potassium is in deposits all around the globe, and there's no foreseeable shortage of that element. And phosphorus is a different story. That's why it's a book. We have very finite supplies of it. And historically, beyond historically, I would just say geologically, phosphorus used to trickle into the environment from certain rocks, igneous rocks that were formed when Earth was formed and the magma cooled. These deposits of phosphorus would slowly leach into the living world. And phosphorus is critical to every living thing on the planet and maybe beyond. It's literally in every single cell. And it governed the amount of life Earth could sustain for billions of years. Once this phosphorus was released from these igneous rocks, it moved into the living world, and it cycled over and over. Like, I guess a simple way to describe it is like a traditional farm that you think of when you think of a pastoral operation. You have a meadow full of grass. The cows eat that grass. They poop. The phosphorus in that poop feeds more grass. The cows eat that grass and they poop, and on and on and on. It's literally the circle of life. As the planet's population of humans began to grow significantly in the early 19th century, we didn't know that it was phosphorus that made certain materials so effective at fertilizing a crop. We just knew that certain ones worked. And manure, obviously, animal manure worked. Human waste was commonly used. And then the British in particular got pretty creative in the early 1800s by exploring different substances. And they found that bones, crushed bones, worked remarkably well. And as I mentioned earlier, phosphorus is in every living cell. So these bones were really rich with fertilizer, and it was in an accessible state. So the British started mining battlefields in Europe, in particular Waterloo, where like 40,000 people fell in like 10 hours back in, I think it was 1815. Well, by the early 1820s, you couldn't find a bone on that battlefield because the British had gone over and plundered it. They built special mills to grind up the bones and spread the dust on their turnips and wheat and whatever, you know, the English needed to grow at the time. Unfortunately, there wasn't a limitless supply of bones, so that propelled them to search for other substances in other regions of the globe, and they landed in the Guano Islands off of South America in the early 1820s or so, and by the 1830s had contracts to ship these mountains of bird poop, dried bird poop off the coast of Peru to spread on their crops. And at the time, it was thought that that was a limitless supply, that there was no horizon for how long the cash would last. It lasted about four decades. By the 1870s, 1880s, we were on the hunt again. And when I say we, the British really pioneered a lot of this, but everybody in the Western Hemisphere got on board, the United States included. And that sent us around the globe again, looking for new sources of phosphorus. And by then, chemistry had advanced to the point where we knew what it was. We knew it was the element phosphorus. And fortunately for humanity, maybe not fortunately for Earth, we were very good at finding this stuff. And in the third wave of phosphorus exploration and exploitation came in the form of these rock deposits, where I mentioned earlier that it was igneous rocks, this, you know, solidified magma that leached the first molecules into the world. The second wave came from sedimentary rocks, which were basically the accumulation of dead sea life raining down on the ocean floor for eons, and then tectonic forces would drive those rock deposits to the surface. And the geologists at the time knew what specifically to kind of look for, and they found islands scattered across the Pacific that had lots of rock phosphorus deposits, as well as here in North America, we found deposits in South Carolina at first, and then Florida, and there's some deposits in, I believe, North Carolina, Idaho, and Utah, but most of the U.S. phosphorus rock reserves are in Florida. And we're on a pace to run out of those deposits in the next 30 or 40 years, at which point the hunt will begin again for new sources of phosphorus. And right now, it's generally held that 70 to 80% of the world's phosphorus rock reserves are in Morocco and its occupied territory of Western Sahara. So you're looking at we talk about energy security. This is, you can look at it as nutritional security. And it could be argued that it's a lot more significant because there are workarounds to oil, and there's no workaround to phosphorus. So there's a paradox going on here. I mentioned earlier that, you know, the algae problem is driven by too much fertilizer washing off the landscape. And so our practices, it's been relatively easily accessible and abundant since the early 1900s, late 1800s, that we haven't had to be efficient with how we used it. Now we have to start thinking about that. And there's a paradox going on here too, because we're still using it at an unsustainable rate because we're fouling our waters with it, but we're also running out of it. And so there's a collision course coming, and that's what this book kind of discusses and explores.
Dan Egan is my guest. He is the author of The Devil's Element, Phosphorus in a World Out of Balance. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, one of the things that's really striking in your book, The Devil's Element, is that some of the key discoveries to do with phosphorus and their sometimes gruesome applications have happened in the context of war. World War II, especially, is kind of crucial to the story of phosphorus, its exploitation. I wonder if you could tell us about one part of this story, which is related to the firebombing of Hamburg, the German city during World War II by the Allies, which killed tens of thousands of civilians and caused nearly a million people to flee. What happened there, and what role did phosphorus play?
Yeah, coincidentally and interestingly, Hamburg is very much a focal point of this story about this element known as the devil's element. It was first discovered in its elemental form in Hamburg in the late 1600s. And at the time, there was a great hunt for what the alchemists called the philosopher's stone. This it turned out to be mythical substance that could transmute base metals like lead into gold and silver. The thinking at the time was that all metals were in a slow evolution toward rare and precious metals. And if we could just figure out what was causing that evolution, that progression, we could speed it up and get rich along the way. That was the philosopher's stone. And people didn't know where it lurked or how to ascertain it, but they tinkered extensively trying to figure out, you know, what might hold this magical key to unleashing incomprehensible riches. And there was a tinkerer, an alchemist in Hamburg, Germany, who believed it could be isolated from the human waste stream, specifically urine. So this was in 1669. After a bunch of hocus pocus and a lot of heat, he finally distilled from a vast amount of urine these waxy, glowing, phosphorescent, really, pebbles. And that was elemental phosphorus. Phosphorus doesn't exist in the natural world any more than, say, a styrofoam cup would. Phosphorus is always bound with oxygen atoms. This alchemist figured out how to cleave those atoms away and reduce the molecules to elemental phosphorus. And there was no real practical application at the time for that. It was more just a curiosity. But eventually, people found out, practical applications for it, not the least of which was as a weapon, because once this waxy substance warms to just a tick above 80 degrees Fahrenheit, it combusts. And so by the 1900s, we were very good at using it for match tips and then weapons. And it turned out that Hamburg itself was burned to the ground in 1943 by incendiary bombs, many of them phosphorus-based. And so its birthplace ended up almost being wiped off the map by a strange historical coincidence. I opened the book with an episode of a man finding a piece of phosphorus along the shore of the Baltic Sea. And that chunk of phosphorus was a remnant from one of the bombs dropped on Hamburg in northern Germany in the summer of 1943. Unfortunately, it looks a lot like amber, which is a prized precious gemstone that people, it's actually fossilized resin that people go specifically hunting for, because the Baltic region used to be a great conifer forest, and the sap that forest leaked eventually fossilized into precious amber. Phosphorus looks a lot like it, and so when people are hunting for amber on the banks of the Elbe River that goes through Hamburg or on the shore of the Baltic Sea, just to the north, sometimes they don't get amber and they get they get elemental phosphorus left over from these incendiary bombs. And as I mentioned earlier, the stuff combusts when it's just a little bit warmer than room temperature. And I start the story with a guy who thought he found something precious and he put it in his pocket, and then his pants exploded in flame and the phosphorus burned right through his thigh. He had to go into the Baltic Sea to put the flames out. But when he'd step back out, it would combust again. So this was in December several years ago. They were going to bring a helicopter to take him to an emergency room, but they thought he'd take down the helicopter. So they finally packed him in wet towels and sped off in an ambulance to the hospital where they removed it. And it really is nasty stuff for anybody to work with. And this isn't an isolated incident either. I mean, it doesn't happen every day, but it happens several times a year. And it's a real challenge for people in emergency rooms to deal with it because it keeps flaring back up. And this gentleman fortunately survived, but he suffered burns to, I think, almost half of his body. And that's a legacy of you know, our tinkering with the devil's element.
And then kind of along the same lines of the way that phosphorus, and especially phosphorus during a time of war, in that case to do with the, you know, the long shadow of World War II, affecting things many, many decades later, World War II and phosphorus both give rise to the invasion of Banaba Island in the Pacific by the Japanese, and also the discovery of phosphorus, or at least the genesis of the discovery of phosphorus in the Western Sahara. I wonder if you could tell us about the first, how following World War II, how phosphorus reserves were discovered and their significance for places like Australia and New Zealand, which were fundamentally transformed. What we would picture of those places was owed really to the plunder of these tropical island reserves of phosphorus.
Yeah, these islands were just basically rocks and sedimentary rocks that were just loaded with phosphorus. And they were first discovered in the early 1900s and exploited to a limited degree prior to World War II, but then it really picked up after that. And what happened was basically, Banaba Island was one, Nauru, Christmas Island. They took these islands down almost to the waterline, and they were inhabited. You know, the people weren't adequately compensated for, you know, the nutritional trove that they were sitting upon. And, you know, in many cases, they were removed from the islands entirely. This cycle of life that I was talking about earlier, how phosphorus would just loop in and out of the living world, it'd be recycled over and over. Well, once we found these rock deposits, we cracked that circle of life and turned it into a line that runs from a mine to a farm field to our water bodies. And, you know, the consequences of right now, we're starting to, you know, we enjoy bountiful crops, but we're starting to pay the price in terms of fouled waters. But it also dramatically changed, you're right, like Australia and New Zealand. New Zealand would not be the great green emerald island that it is today if it wasn't for this artificial fertilizer, and, you know, based largely on rocks from islands in the South Pacific. The New Zealanders to this day, they essentially crop dust their countryside to green up the pastures to sustain, you know, all the sheep that they're raising. It was a much more brown and desiccated place before phosphorus fertilizer, chemical fertilizer, entered the picture. And so, yeah, it wasn't just a matter of farmers having things a little bit easier. It fundamentally changed, you know, the landscape of a lot of places.
I'm speaking with Dan Egan. He's an award-winning writer. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Element, Phosphorus and a World Out of Balance. That's published by Norton. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in the post-war period, Spanish geologists were dispatched by the Spanish dictator Francisco Franco to Spain's then colony of Western Sahara You mentioned earlier in the program that 70 to 80% of the remaining phosphorus reserves in the world are in Morocco or in Western Sahara, which Morocco occupied in the 1970s when Spain retreated in the face of native resistance. Can you tell us about Western Sahara and Morocco, the significance of the largest concentration of phosphorus being in this occupied area?
Yeah, it's a strange kind of geopolitical coincidence that so much of what we have left in terms of phosphorus reserves is in such a unstable area. And it was the Spanish, they were on the hunt in the middle of the 20th century for their own phosphorus deposits, and they found a ton, just a vast, the biggest deposits in Western Sahara, along with Morocco, which is similar geologically. And this had dire consequences for the native nomads of the Sahara region. A massive mine was opened in the early 1970s. And at that point, I think, you know, Spain was just in the final throes of decolonizing, and they pulled out, and Morocco moved in and basically kicked out the native people of the Sahara, and they were exiled, essentially, in a war. They called it the War of the Sands. It wasn't just sand, it was phosphorus sand, phosphorus rock. But they were displaced and put in tent camps, like tens of thousands of people put in these tent camps in nearby Algeria. And the thought at the time was, let's just, you know, clear these people from the battle area, and then we'll get things settled and they can move back. Well, that was in the early 1970s. So it's been a half century of people. Now it's some 100,000 people live in these tent villages while Morocco continues to operate this Western Sahara mine. It's become increasingly controversial in the Western Hemisphere for people to be buying what many argue is this ill-gotten gain. And there's actually violence flaring up again. And the mine is protected by this massive berm that has mines and is very, very, very heavily armed. And there's a fear that, you know, this War of the Sands is going to flicker to life again, particularly as, you know, things get more unstable, both in terms of fertilizer and food. Back in 2008, there was a fertilizer shortage, and there were riots from Haiti to India, and there was bloodshed, and it was kind of a window into the future because, as I said earlier, oil is prized, but phosphorus is essential.
So tell us how Morocco at this point benefits from the occupation of Western Sahara and the phosphorus reserves there.
One of the reasons that Morocco was so interested in Western Sahara's phosphorus deposits was they're so vast that if the Western Saharans were in control of this resource, they could really match Morocco price-wise for fertilizer. So this is really kind of a way to corner the market. And people, you know, there's been a lot of smart people looking at this and thinking, well, this is not going to end good. I should mention, just in the last couple of months, it's been announced that there were, I think it's Norway, significant rock deposits found up there. But I think it's still unclear how concentrated these rock deposits are and how you know, viable they are as a product for a mining operation. Right now, all eyes are on Morocco and Western Sahara, and it's just, you know, I talked to a number of people who make their livings just trying to project what's going to happen, and they just see that the linchpin is going to be Morocco. And as we're seeing right now, what's going on with, you know, the earthquake there, it's not the best run country, the most stable place. And you know, you imagine once the U.S. runs out of its reserves, it's going to have to redefine its relationship with Morocco and perhaps Western Sahara, which isn't really its own country right now. It's just recognized by the U.N. as a territory in dispute. just so happens that this disputed territory is sitting on, you know, this extraordinary cache of the element that sustains life for billions of people.
And I believe that Donald Trump recognized Morocco's control over Western Sahara when the rest of the world has not. I wanted to turn to talk about the way that the fortunes of phosphorus have played out in the United States. Going back to the Great Lake that you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Lake Erie, I wonder if you could tell us about the story of phosphorus as it relates to that Great Lake, starting with the story of Procter & Gamble and the development of phosphorus-containing synthetic detergents. In fact, can you just start by reminding us what synthetic detergents are?
Sure. Yeah, synthetic detergents, or detergent, really, didn't really exist until in the marketplace until after World War II. And then the industry exploded along with the manufacturing of washing machines. Prior to World War II, laundry was typically done by hand. And, you know, it was a day of drudgery, wash day. Washing machines promised to essentially eliminate that with the push of a button. But the problem was traditional soap wasn't potent enough to get clothes as clean as they would otherwise be with a hard hand scrubbing. So chemists of the time started to try to derive a concoction that would be more potent. And they struck upon a formulation that was largely phosphorus, specifically phosphates. It's, as we were talking earlier, rock or phosphorus and oxygen atoms bound together. Well, a box of, say, Tide in 1950 or 60 was almost a box of phosphate. To keep things clean, I'll just refer to it as phosphorus going forward. And, you know, at the time, people thought it was a miracle. But by the late 1960s, they realized there was a downside to pumping all this phosphorus into the environment, and that was lakes were going soupy green, and none more so than Lake Erie, the shallowest and warmest of the five Great Lakes, which collectively hold some 20% of the world's fresh surface water. By 1969, 1970, the U.S. press was referring to Lake Erie as America's Dead Sea. At the time, they didn't know that it was phosphorus specifically causing it. It was very much a likely suspect, but it hadn't been proven. And not surprisingly, the detergent industry wasn't really too eager to accept blame for this. So they pointed towards other chemicals and elements that were flooding the environment during this era of, you know, massive industrial expansion following World War II. And so nobody knew or could prove exactly what was causing it, so there was no regulations that were established to try to solve the problem. And so some Canadian researchers got very creative, and they decided to basically turn some lakes up in far northwestern Ontario into oversized test tubes. By that I mean they would dose these lakes with various elements or chemical concoctions to see what the results were. And one of the most famous experiments they did up there was they cut a lake in half with a polyurethane curtain, so it was the exact same water chemistry. And in simple terms, one side got phosphorus and one side didn't. And one side, the phosphorus side, 2 weeks later was green as a golf course, and the other side was, you know, blue as a Canadian lake should be. They went up and took a picture of this from the air, and that picture changed everything. All of a sudden, you weren't hearing, you know, these kind of obscure and highly technical arguments from biologists and geologists before state legislatures. They were seeing a picture of the consequences of a lake overdosed with phosphorus. And that led to phosphorus being largely pulled from laundry detergent. It also led to the Clean Water Act, or helped create the Clean Water Act in 1972, which dramatically throttled the flow of phosphorus into the environment, as well as other industrial chemicals. And so Lake Erie was being called the America's Dead Sea back in the late 60s, early 70s. It had such a bad reputation that Dr. Seuss even took a crack at Lake Erie in his beloved book, The Lorax. I don't remember the line specifically, but he was just talking about what a wasteland Lake Erie had become. That was in 1971 or 72. We got the Clean Water Act in 1972, and just as the scientists predicted, if we put Lake Erie on a phosphorus diet, it would recover quickly, and it did. So much so that by 1985, some researchers at Ohio State University wrote Dr. Seuss, a.k.a. Theodore Geisel, and said, "You should come see Lake Erie because it's not the mess that it was even a decade ago." And he responded. He didn't come for a visit, but he pulled that material about Lake Erie out of the book. So if you go to the bookstore today, you're not going to find any reference to Lake Erie. But you probably should, because while the lake recovered dramatically by the mid-1980s, beginning at the turn of this last century, say 20 years ago, it started suffering these algae explosions again. And this time the problem isn't phosphorus-based detergents and other industrial excrements. It's largely waste coming off of agricultural fields. Wastewater treatment plants also, they remove some of the nutrients from their waste stream, but not all of them. And that's a piece of the problem as well. But this is an unfortunate legacy of the Clean Water Act, because it didn't address address agriculture pollution. It largely left it untouched.
Yeah, so how did the Clean Water Act, which was responsible for cleaning up Lake Erie, how did it miss one dimension, that is agriculture and runoff from agriculture, which has now again led to algae, which is smothering Lake Erie once more?
Yeah, that's a great point. So at the time, it was thought that the problem could be solved by basically not so much plugging smokestacks and pipes, but scrubbing what was coming out of them with technology, with pollution control technology. And that was really considered, and it was, the low-hanging fruit at the time. We thought, if we stop these waste streams, we're going to solve the problem. And they were right. And at the time, the way agriculture was conducted across the globe, but in the United States specifically, it was a much smaller and much more diffuse source of pollution, because farms were much smaller and cattle were spread across the landscape. But 50 years on, and so at that point, they actually referred to, you know, the stuff coming out of smokestacks and pipes, and they still do, refer to it as point source pollution. And agriculture was considered a non-point source pollution, just basically too diffuse to really get your hands on. And at the time, you could argue that it was. 50 years down the road, the face of agriculture has changed dramatically as farms have gotten much, much bigger. And those farms don't just produce steaks and milk. They produce a lot of waste, too much waste for the landscape to handle. And so you have, these pond-size manure lagoons at some of these larger farms that really are point source pollution, because it can't just flow into the water. It's going to be every bit as toxic as what was coming out of the pipes that were, poisoning and polluting lakes in the 1960s. Yet this exemption, this non-point exemption in the Clean Water Act persists to this day. And it's not a coincidence that, as agriculture has grown and concentrated, so has the pollution problems in not only Lake Erie, but lakes, from Florida's Lake Okeechobee. I did a story for the New York Times back in July about what a mess that lake was causing for the coastal cities on both the Atlantic and the Gulf, because if the lake gets too high, the water has to be released, and it's not just water, it's toxic algae-ridden water, and it goes down canals and rivers to the Florida's two coasts, much to the consternation of people who are living there. So that really is something, this book isn't meant to be a prescription saying we need to do this, this, and that, and we will solve the problem. It's more to connect the dots and to inform people, like, why is your lake going green and foul? And it's because of what's washing off the landscape, and much of that is agricultural driven. So, I think a good place to start is to reconsider the exemption that agriculture has enjoyed from the Clean Water Act. And I'm not trying to demonize farmers. They're just operating in the system that, has been set up for them. But that system isn't working so well anymore, particularly when it comes to water pollution. Another thing that I discuss in the book is the wisdom of ethanol, because 40% of the corn that we're growing in the United States today ends up in a fuel in our gas tanks. And you know, this is not considered by most educated people as a net environmental benefit because of the energy inputs it takes to grow that corn and the fertilizer inputs as well. And also the ethics, morality of, you know, taking food literally off of people's tables and putting it into our gas tanks when, you know, it's been shown that it really isn't a net environmental benefit. So that's that, you know, I talked earlier about pipes and smokestacks being the low-hanging fruit. Well, you could argue today that ethanol is a big juicy piece of low-hanging fruit that could go a long way to address our pollution of our waterways with agriculture. The problem is it's politically popular because, you know, the whole industry is really, you know, centered in the middle of the United States, and in the middle of that middle is Iowa. And Iowa is such a politically important state. You know, it was the first in the primary season, no longer the case for the Democrats, but the Republicans still. If you want to do well in Iowa, you have to pledge allegiance to ethanol. And it's been this way for decades. So when I talk about supporting ethanol, it's completely propped up by the federal government, which mandates that basically 10% of the fuel in our gas tanks be derived from biofuels, which is mostly ethanol. And that mandate goes away, so does, you know, ethanol as we know it today. But almost every politician that goes through Iowa, you know, talks about how important it is to our energy security going forward, when most people outside of the ethanol industry recognize that it's just popular politically, but it's an environmental loser.
Stepping back, how do you think the cycle of phosphorus could be restored? On the one hand, it sounds like something that is being produced in excess, and on some level, listeners might think maybe it's a good thing if it's running out, but you're also saying the scarcity of phosphorus is actually very significant and very serious, and the estimates for when it will run out, maybe in the next few centuries, but that it is finite. So how could our systems of production be structured differently so that there wasn't massive amounts of phosphorus wasted on all sorts of levels, including in food production?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of inefficiencies in the system. It's been estimated that about only 20% of the phosphorus mined actually makes it into the food that's on our tables. The rest is just basically wasted during the mining and the refining and the application of it on agriculture fields. So there's a lot of room for efficiency there. But I think most importantly is the idea of this circle of life that I was talking about before. We're never going to go back, hopefully not in our lifetimes at least, to a, you know, a planet with a billion people and, you know, a landscape that can sustain whatever's put upon it, because it's not such a vast volume, the volume that it is today. But I think it's critical that we recognize these pond-size manure lagoons as the nutritional and economic trove that it is. I mean, we were talking earlier about the British being so desperate that they were looting battlefields for bones to derive, you know, phosphorus fertilizer. We can get back there. You know, it's been estimated by some that if we were to be as efficient as possible, we could reduce our phosphorus, mined phosphorus demand by up to 50%, which will extend the reserves going forward into the future for future generations. There's a lot that's happening technologically right now. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and here in Wisconsin, earlier this year, there were reports that there were farmers that were making as much and maybe even more in methane sales from anaerobic digesters installed on their farms that would pull the fuel, the natural fuel, out of the manure and put it into the grid. And so they were saying, you know, we're at this tipping point where the manure may be worth more than the milk, which is kind of absurd. But it's also fascinating to think, you know, what if you further refine it for its nitrogen and its phosphorus? And One of the big problems right now is that this manure, it's just, you know, just like cows make milk every day, they make manure every day. And it's an economic loser for a farmer to have to put it in a tanker and move it more than 10 miles from his dairy operation to put it on a field. So most of it just gets spread by convenience too close to these dairy operations for the landscape to absorb that burden. If you concentrate it and put it in pellet form, in a form that's every bit as pure, pristine as what's coming out of the ground, well, now you have a product that you can move around the country, not just around your neighborhood. So that's one way forward. And we can do similar things with the human waste stream. And this sounds kind of gross, but it's life. And, you know, I was talking earlier about how Hamburg, Germany is central to the story because it was the birthplace of phosphorus and it was a place that was burned to the ground by phosphorus. And right now, today, on the banks of the Elbe River is the world's arguably like the most technologically advanced wastewater treatment plant operation on the planet, large scale speaking. And that's because Germany has recognized that, you know, they're facing phosphorus. They really have none of their own. They don't have any of their own phosphorus deposits. So in an effort to get more fertilizer independent there and to protect the waterways, they're requiring that by the end of this decade, essentially all the phosphorus in the human waste stream be pulled out at these wastewater treatment plants and repackaged into commercial grade phosphorus. And they can do this to the point where it is as pure as anything that's coming out of a modern fertilizer factory. That's encouraging because it's not going to be just Germany. It's going to be, it hasn't gone EU-wide, but I think other countries are adopting this. And I think it's inevitable that the U.S. will at some point, too, because these cyanobacteria outbreaks that are plaguing waterways from coast to coast are only getting worse. And that's because we haven't figured out how to manage this, you know, precious substance that is really just like a biological accelerant. It's almost like throwing fuel on a flame. We've been throwing too much fuel on the flame for too long, and we need to realize that A, we got to conserve what's left, and B, we've got to take better care of our waterways.
Well, let me end by asking you about this aspect of the cycle of phosphorus. You mentioned that there's just massively too much animal manure produced. Many people have been arguing that the production of animals, farm animals, cows, pigs, etc., be radically scaled back anyway because of climate considerations and the amount of land that dairies and meat production takes place on the landscape. Do you think that's part of a solution here in terms of reining in the overproduction of phosphorus in particular places?
As far as our diet, when you look at it from a macro perspective, there are a whole lot of good reasons why we should cut back on meat. Just the climate impacts, the individual impacts on human health. But I'm not going to get into that debate right now because it's way above the level that I'm flying at. I do think that changes are going to come because right now food and water are on a collision course and we need both. You know, I had breakfast this morning and I'll have lunch in 20 minutes and I'll have dinner tonight. And so I am arguably part of the problem. But I also know that I deserve to have safe, fresh water. And I don't think we've really talked enough in this country about what, you know, where we're headed with this water pollution. In 2014, some of the toxin from one of these algae blooms got sucked into the Toledo drinking water system. Toledo's on the western shore of Lake Erie. And that knocked out the water supply for several days. And this wasn't a case where the water was, you know, polluted by, you know, some bacteria and you could boil it and drink it safely. If you boiled it, you would only concentrate the poison. So the National Guard had to be called in to provide tankers of drinking water and pallets of baby formula. And this is on the shore of the world's largest freshwater system. I mean, here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, And we were at a point where we couldn't even safely treat drinking water supply from, you know, one of the world's great freshwater reserves. So that's something that we really need to consider going forward. It's like we need food, but just as direly we need safe water. So I'm not going to say we all need to kick meat. I don't think that'd be great for the planet. I don't know how politically practical it is at this point, but we do need to recognize the connection between, you know, what we're doing to raise our food and what we're doing to poison our water. So that's one thing to think about. And so night soil is a polite way of describing human waste. And it's gross to think about, but for thousands of years, human waste has been used to grow food. This is a finite resource, this phosphorus, and we're going to have to learn to reuse it. I'm not advocating that we spread human waste on crops of corn today, but we do have technologies where we can pull from that waste the element, phosphorus, in a form that's every bit as pure as something coming from a chemical factory. And I think we need to get thrifty in every way possible if we want to both sustain, you know, soil fertility for the coming years, decades, and centuries, and we want to protect our water supply.
Dan Egan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Egan is an award-winning writer. He's journalist in residence at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Science. He's the author of The Devil's Element, Phosphorus and a World Out of Balance, which you can find a link to at againstthegrain.org. His other books include The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.